Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Tewitt and your co-host today is Mike Rouse. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The main topic today is Wall Street, which faces a crunch week as the US Senate considers a reform bill put together by President Obama, and Goldman Sachs executives face a congressional panel which is scrutinising the role of investment banks in the financial crisis. Goldman Sachs, now charged with fraud by the SEC, has been memorably described as a giant vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Is that fair? How far was the financial crisis actually engineered? Is it time to get tough? And if so, what sort of regulations are appropriate? Give us a call with your thoughts. Our number 233-88266 or email backchat at rthk.org.hk or go to our Facebook page and join the debate there. And after 9.15 today, should Ocean Park import wild dolphins? Joining us for the discussion in our central studio, David Webb, founder of website.com, a shareholder activist, Enzio von Pfeil, founder of economicclock.com, and joining us on the line, Joseph Sternberg, is editorial page writer for the Wall Street Journal Asia. David Webb, let's start with you. Good morning.
Morning.
It seems like a bit of a crunch time, as I say, for Wall Street in some respects this week. They're getting their comeuppance? Is it fair?
Well, I think there is a need for an overhaul of the regulatory system in America in particular, but elsewhere. It was exposed during the financial crisis that there was nobody really looking after, in supervisory terms, these massive conglomerates of financial entities, insurance and banks and investment banking, all bundled into the same thing in some cases. AIG was the one that sticks in most people's minds. The insurance companies underneath that were each regulated by their local insurance regulators, and those, in fact, were perfectly solvent. But the entity above it that was writing guarantees on other people's borrowings, basically, that was not properly supervised. So there's, I think, a need to remove the complexity that prevents supervisors properly overseeing banks. And that means moving back towards something they had in after the 1933 crash, which was the Glass-Steagall Act, and saying, well, look, banks must have been understood by average civil servants who run central bank supervisory functions, because the government backstop is always implicitly there to protect savers. And so the bank cannot engage in stuff which is so esoteric that the regulators can't understand it. Separate that stuff out. Goldman Sachs, for example, is now a regulated bank. It put itself into the Federal Reserve framework only after the crisis, and so did Morgan Stanley. And so they need to sell off or demerge their hedge fund type operations and leave themselves with bits that the government should be willing to deal with as a regulator.
David, this isn't only a regulatory issue, though, is it? There's a deeper moral problem here.
Moral problem with people trying to make money.
Not making money so much as encouraging people to borrow sums for mortgages that they couldn't possibly service.
I think there's other fundamental problems with in the US housing market. There's these monsters called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are they guarantee loans effectively. One of the problems with the whole system was that a large portion of the U.S. mortgage base, anything below a certain limit, called the jumbo size of it, which was, I think, about $250,000 U.S. Anything below that could be guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And although everything they ever printed, every bond they ever issued, said this does not carry the guarantee of the federal government, over time, expectations built up that the government did stand behind it, and indeed they finally did, partly because people like China had gobs of the stuff in their foreign reserves. I think that they should have allowed Fannie and Freddie to fail, because that would not have been in any way deceptive to the people who bought their bonds. They should have allowed AIG to fail. But having the principle behind those entities was this will make housing, quotes, more affordable. But when you give cheaper credit to everybody, it doesn't make housing more affordable. It just pushes prices up. And then they had the problems with mortgage securitization, where the people who were creating the loans were not holding the loans. They were just passing them on into securitization vehicles. And so you had people who were paid on commission to find people who couldn't afford to borrow and make them borrow. So there were those kinds of problems with the system, some of which have not been resolved yet. They still haven't decided
and
what
not,
to do.
Not even checking, even in a cursory way, whether that person had a credit history, what it was good or bad, whether they had an income,
Never
mind what it was.
No paperwork at all. Just living on the hope that the property's values would keep going up.
And they could flip them and make a profit.
Or at least take out the equity to pay the interest. So a lot of people became homeowners, which was perhaps a political wish, but economic unreality. It wasn't affordable for them. And you can't blame people like Goldman Sachs for creating those conditions. The politicians created those conditions over a long period of time. And they have to hold some responsibility for putting it right.
But Enzio von Pfeil, good morning to you. The charge against Goldman is that, that they were deliberately, or they were allowing Paulson to deliberately create these instruments to fail and were shorting them. Do you think that kind of thing was widespread?
Oh, I'm sure it was, and I'm sure that Goldman is only the tip of the iceberg. I'm afraid that all of these houses will be caught with equal amounts of what's going to morph into sophistry about trying to tell the world that actually what they were doing wasn't really quite so bad. So I'm sure that this is more just the tip of the iceberg with Goldman's. It's not the only one out there doing this stuff.
But if this is all the SEC could come up with, I think it's rather feeble. And looking at their case in detail, as I did last week, what they're essentially saying is that a very sophisticated bank which bought these products, which were created by Goldman, was somehow misled. Now, when you look at the disclosures, and that's what the judges will have to do and the juries, but when they look at it, they'll probably find very full disclosure on what was in the product. Whenever you buy a product like that, there must be somebody else on the other side selling it to you and taking the opposite viewpoint, that the value of these products will go down rather than up. It's either the bank or it's a client of the bank, and fundamentally banks shouldn't be disclosing names of their clients to their other clients. That's one of the principles of confidentiality. So I think the case is very weak.
I think there's something in that. But on the other hand, if Goldman has said, listen, we took a $15 million fee to structure this in a particular way.
You think they would do it for free? I mean, it was a billion-dollar product, so 1.5% is what they were paid to do that. Apparently, they also took some for a while on their own books. So they had an exposure and lost some money on it. But the allegation is that Goldman should have disclosed that their other client had proposed a list of these product of the underlying securities that were going into the what they call the CDO product, the synthetic collateralized debt obligation. But although they could propose whatever they liked, in the end there was another firm called ACA, which was ultimately responsible for selecting those securities, and it rejected some of the ones that were proposed by Paulson and Co. And put some of its own in. So, at the end of the day, they were only acting as a portfolio selection officer. Another entity, part of the system that is to blame in all this, is the ratings agencies, because all of the underlying products were rated AAA. They were double BA.
Investment grade, yeah.
Investment grade, anyway. The ratings were disclosed, and everyone was relying on those. And there are conflicts of interest in the rating system, which have not yet been addressed, in terms of the fact that bulk of the fees come from the issuers of these products.
Mm. Okay, let's go to Joseph Stoneberg now from Wall Street Journal Asia. Good morning to you.
Hi, Hugh.
Thanks so much indeed for joining us. There are sort of signs that, Goldman's is very strongly defended their actions. On the other hand, they seem to be throwing some of their executives to the walls a little bit, because there is this political momentum in the United States. What do you think about the Goldman case, first of all, that the SEC has put together?
Well, I think the key thing to remember here is the phrase you just used, political momentum. I think that, the SEC is a government agency. They sit in Washington. Their office physically is very near Capitol Hill. They're obviously very aware of which way the political winds are blowing in Washington. I think that there is this growing momentum to try to blame anyone other than the government itself for this crisis. I think that David is absolutely right about some of the fundamental problems that we had here, particularly the role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in creating this housing bubble, which then all of the investment banks like Goldman were simply trying to, you know, profit off of just by betting on, you know, one way or the other and which way the housing market would go. I think that, you know, certainly American monetary policy played a role in making all of this excess cash available for people to gamble with. I think that it's really important to remember that this case against Goldman was filed right on the eve of a major Senate debate about financial regulation.
They said there was no reform. They did explicitly say there was no connection between
well,
the two.
Well, of course they'll say there's no connection, but I think that certainly you have to sort of look at all of this in context, and I think that certainly it's undeniable that the timing is very convenient here in terms of giving, you know, various congressmen good opportunities to grandstand on this on the eve of an important vote on this regulatory bill. It's also worth noting here that this case against Goldman came out at the same time that a different part of the SEC was issuing an investigation into that agency's own failure to regulate and catch an investment Ponzi scheme, you know, the whole Sanford case, which actually did ensnare small investors. I mean, that's an important point to remember about this Goldman case. We're not talking about babes in the woods or grandma's pension here. I mean, we're talking about very sophisticated investors who were on both sides of the trade at the root of this Goldman case. And, you know, I have to wonder why the regulators are even focusing on this when you can find plenty of examples, whether it's Bernie Madoff or the Sanford scheme, that actually did affect the small investors that the SEC was created to protect.
Yeah, in which the SEC failed to detect.
Joseph Somo, do you agree with David Webb then that there is a need for more regulation, for more supervision, more simplification?
I think the main problem that you're always going to run into when you try to regulate the financial markets is that the incentives are so great for people to find loopholes in the rules. I think it's really dangerous to think that any particular set of regulations can protect us from, you know, having this sort of bubble. I mean, and I've said it before, I really do have to wonder how effectively Congress, especially in the U.S., can regulate the financial system when the incentives are all wrong for them. I mean, if you look at the role that Fannie and Freddie played in this, and I mean, the reports that have been coming out that, you know, if you're going to talk about deception, Fannie and Freddie were really deceiving the markets about the, you know, basic nature of a lot of the mortgages that they were bundling up. I mean, they were trying to pass off a significant quantity of subprime mortgages as prime for years during the height of the bubble. And I think that the reason that was happening is because the political incentives exist to encourage homeownership, whether it makes economic sense for the homeowner. And I, you know, I think as long as you have that kind of pressure, or as long as you have pressure on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low for the sake of economic growth or fuller employment, you know, I think it's going to be very difficult for Congress to come up with regulations that will keep the next bubble from forming.
You can push the parallel so far, can't you? The charge against Goldman is basically that they were creating products that were designed to fail.
Well, but
and they were going to benefit from the failure.
Well, look, they were, one of the counterparties on this trade was willing to bet that the, you know, mortgage market would decline. But, I mean, it's important to remember that they also found at least two very sophisticated investors to take the other side of that bet, that they were willing to bet that the housing market would go up. I mean, the reason that this whole Paulson and Company connection here has become such a big deal is because he very famously made a lot of money with his short bet on the housing market, you know, making a very well-timed bet. But, I mean, it could well be that the bubble had lasted for another 6 months or a year, and he would just be, you know, sitting out there in oblivion, one of hundreds or thousands of others of hedge fund managers.
Yeah, he can't. He could have been early, or he could have been just wrong and lost money on the trade. I don't think there's anything wrong with creating a product that allows you to bet one way or the other on the future of something, any more than it is to bet that a horse will win, or to write a bet that it will win and therefore bet that it will lose.
But there's perhaps something to be said that they at least could have told the others that they were backing a horse that was betting on losing everything.
Well, but it's self-evident, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to, you know, be making that kind of long bet. I mean, why shouldn't you assume that someone's making a short bet? I mean, you know, it could just as easily have turned out that the two counterparties, ACA and IKB, I think, was the other bank, taking the long side of this bet. I mean, would we be having this conversation about how they had somehow participated in defrauding Paulson and Company if their long bet had paid off?
I still think that, I totally agree here that people have got to look at the regulations, and there's a lot of scope for improvement. But I still think this comes back to a fundamental moral issue. There's nothing wrong with people making a profit. There's nothing wrong with people doing honest work. But that the whole saga, the whole pyramid, was riddled with people who put their consciences in the freezer and just went out and did things that they must have known were morally wrong. You can't sign a guy up who has no income for a mortgage for $250,000.
But the system allowed him to.
Yes.
Yeah, that wasn't a Goldman thing. I mean, if you're going to be assigning moral blame here, let's talk about the U.S. Congress. I mean, Congressman Barney Frank, who sits on a very powerful financial services committee that had a lot of oversight over Fannie and Freddie, very famously said that he wanted to roll the dice with them, you know, getting them to fund all of these subprime mortgages. I mean, that was an explicit government policy to do that.
So
I don't know how you can fault Goldman or Citi or J.P. Morgan or any of the other investment
banks. That's right. There were directives.
The point about it is that Goldman, engineered the situation, this collapse in which they would benefit.
No, they didn't engineer the collapse. They simply made a bet on it.
Rather,
their client did.
Yeah, because their client designed contributed towards this product, which was designed to fail.
And the client said, "I would like to sell this basket of securities. Will you find me a buyer?" And they said, "Well, we'll see what we can do." And they found a buyer.
The basket changed
because they wanted a selection company called ACA, which also ended up buying some of this. Or rather, its parent did. They wanted a selection company to put some kind of a brand stamp on it. And so it wasn't exactly the secure portfolio that the seller, Paulson, originally wanted to sell. But, you know, I don't think you can somehow say that this means that Goldman's created the financial crash.
I mean, I think it's very difficult to look at this case and find. If this case is going to become the definitive, evidence that Goldman somehow engineered the crash, it's very scant evidence. I mean, look, the trades involved here were somewhere between $1 and $4 billion, and I don't see how that kind of trade, just that relatively small scale, could have brought about a trillion-dollar contraction.
All right, you said it's the tip of the iceberg. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is there's another huge contradiction out there, which is the campaign finance side of this, which is that Congress is, in a way, caught in a bind. On the one hand, it wants to be a good guy, but then it's also a bad guy. I mean, it's already accepted, I think, $34 million in campaign finance from the financial sector alone. So if they're actually going to be enacting legislation which is much quote unquote better or more moralistic, I hardly, from my work on Capitol Hill, I can hardly believe that there're going to be sort of tough new proper regulations coming out that will actually stem this kind of moral turpitude.
But there is moral turpitude. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. Well, I don't think that you can legislate away morals. I think that misrepresenting products isn't something good. But I also think that...
Did Goldman misrepresent products from what you know?
From my knowledge of the newspaper articles, they weren't telling the world that Paulson was on. I had a huge short position selling this product. But again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going.
Would you like your broker to tell other people what you're selling? I mean, because that basically is what you're saying.
David, I would like to know what I'm buying. Yes, and I would like.
You'd like to know the names of the sellers when you're buying, but you don't want your name to be known when you're selling.
The point being that if I don't know what I'm buying, then.
But you do know. You've got a portfolio in front of you. I mean, in this case,
yes,
there was
I'm not being told. I'm being told by people who are being very economical with the truth.
Are you saying that Goldman Sachs is no more than a broker? That they could sell, they're like an auction house that's knowingly selling fakes, but they're saying...
Yeah, I mean, I don't hold any love for Goldman Sachs. I think Goldman Sachs should have been allowed to take a huge hit by allowing AIG to fail. The government was wrong to have bailed out AIG. They did it under the supervision of a Treasury Secretary who used to chair Goldman Sachs, Henry Paulson, the other Paulson in this. What they should have done, the government, is allow AIG to fail, let the investment banks and others take the hit from any products they were engaged with AIG, which were things like credit default swaps, where...
No, sorry, I'm saying, are you saying that Goldman Sachs are just they have no obligation, they can do whatever they like, they can knowingly sell crappy products?
It was fairly priced at the time. The buyer was willing to buy it, the seller was willing to sell it.
So they have...
The market then tanked, and of course the value of that product went down. But, you know, so what? You can buy a share in an IPO and then the business prospects of the company tank. Mm.
You can.
And you lose money.
Your point about identifying the sellers is a reasonable one. You don't want your broker sort of putting all your private stuff out there.
Yeah.
But I think if they'd said, look, we were paid a big fee here to put against something, the guy's taking a huge short position, and these aren't randomly collected bits of product underlying it. These are things that he's deliberately chosen.
He asked the selection agent to choose, and they rejected quite a lot of them and put some of their own in as well. The point is, at the end, the customer was able to see the entire portfolio.
I think
able to buy it. I mean, I think we're getting away from this is a very detailed case involving a relatively small amount of money in the context of the financial collapse. There were thousands of billions involved, not just 1 billion. I think that the politicians would be better spending their time if they were to focus on the systemic reforms that they need to do, dismantling the monsters of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example. I also think that around the world we've got to take a new look at the way we protect depositors, because I don't think the current system works at all. I think if you want a government guarantee on your savings, then you should lend the money to the government and let them take the higher interest rate they can get from taking risk by lending it back to banks. That's what Japan used to do with its postal savings system. And there's no reason why governments couldn't bring back a system like that and make it very clear to the public that you can either get risk-free rates, but you'll always get your money back from the government, or you can lend it to a bank and take some risk, and if it fails, we won't be there to bail it out. But because we'll be lending this money back to the banking system, we still have a duty to supervise its capital adequacy, and we have money at risk. So, you know, make a much clearer distinction than present, where banks can compete on the back of a government guarantee, effectively.
Yes, I think it's this no fail, too big to fail thing has got to go somehow, hasn't it? Because the market will punish, ultimately, people who do foolish things.
You know, if I can jump in here,
so
I mean,
sure about that.
From that perspective, this is an example of how seriously wrong Congress is going, because there hasn't been any serious effort in the U.S. to deal with the
big to fail problem. Can I put this to you, Joseph Stenberg? That are you saying that Goldman Sachs were just a broker, and that they knew they had this bad product, and they're saying, well, it's okay, we've got a buyer, we've got a seller, that's fine?
Well, how on earth are they supposed to have known it was a bad product? I mean,
because the man who put it together was shorting it.
This is 2020 hindsight you're using.
I mean, it stands to reason that in any if we were to go out to the trading floor in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange today, you would see some sellers and you would see some buyers. I mean, it stands to reason that on any one of the transactions taking place in the stock exchange today, one of the parties in that transaction is selling perhaps because they think that the stock will go down in price in the future, and one of the parties because they think it'll go up in the future. And I think that that basically is the sort of situation we have here. I mean, you can only we'll only know 6 months down the road which of those two counterparties on the stock exchange floor were right.
Even in bubble market conditions, would it be right for a broker to identify someone who was shorting PCCW, for example, in 2000 when it was 20 times its current price? People who bought the shares and held them after that lost 95% of their money. Does that make it a, quote, bad product, or was it fairly priced on the day it was sold based on the market price? And should you have demonized the seller for making money on it? I don't think so, but... you know, you may have a different view.
Oh. Yeah, but I think it was being unsold as a shonky product where they weren't, where the buyer wasn't being told what was going on inside that product after ACA got hold of it.
Okay, we're going to continue the discussion after the news at 9 o'clock. We're going to break for 5 minutes. Now we... Welcome back to Mac Chat, this Monday morning, first one of the week. Mike Rouse is with us. I'm Hugh Chewerton as your host. Continuing our discussion now about Wall Street as Goldman Sachs faces those fraud charges. They're sitting, some executives will be facing a congressional panel this week, scrutinizing the role of investment banks in that financial crisis. We also have the reform bill put together by President Obama coming up in the Senate. Joining us for the discussion, we have in our central studio, Yvonne Feil, founder of EconomicClock.com, Joseph Sternberg, editorial page writer for the Wall Street Journal Asia, and David Webb, founder of website.com and a shareholder activist. Later in the program, also talking about dolphins and Ocean Park. A comment from Chris on our Facebook page: we should just ask the people working on financial derivatives to explain for us what their products are really doing to the stock market and ultimately to the average person who has nothing to do with the products they design and sell. Simply put, there are still too many legal loopholes regarding the regulation of stock trading in Wall Street. We all know Goldman's crime is obvious, but the laws that regulate it do not depict it as such, so it's a hard case for the SEC. Enzio von Feil,
yeah.
Is Goldman a vampire squid or not?
I know you think so.
I just love that phrase. I think a lot of people do, don't they?
I think it's a wonderful phrase, but I think that you have to really perhaps stretch it out to the financial industry as such, but I'm not sure that labelings as such will do any good.
Does the industry do any good?
Oh, yes. I mean, it still allocates capital, and the statement on Facebook...
Really? To bankers? I mean, what's it for? I have no idea what it's for.
No, well, I think what's happened is that it's lost, again, what David and I were discussing...
It's to look after your MPF money, Hugh. That's what it's for.
Well, it's not doing a very good job.
It's also there to lend money, which it still does. Sometimes it does a little bit more of that. Sometimes it does a little bit less. The president's doing a little bit less because it's got sidetracked into much more golden pots of money. But I would, just going back to a very basic premise of mine, you can't legislate away lack of morals. You can stick in as many laws as you want, but it's just not going to happen because people will always circumvent, in particular where you have a system of campaign finance, which basically is telling Congress, on the one hand, be tough on these financial institutions. On the other hand, hey, financial institutions, we need your money in order to win our next campaign. Well, how's that going to work in practice?
All right, so you don't regulate what? You instill Confucius or what? How do you change morality?
Shift the incentives and deterrence, don't you? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, in campaign finance, they have done some things. I mean, McCain-Feingold changed the rules, didn't it, and said no individual can contribute more than X, $2,500 or something per candidate.
Yeah, but
there are sort of parallel systems.
Supreme Court's just come out saying that you can finance unlimited amounts. So I think that that's very much a root cause of a lot of these things that David and I and, you know, also Joe were discussing also about AIG, that I think that campaign finance is very much at the root of this. And if that were to be limited in a very big way, then one could get back to the real issues, such as with Goldman's, which is, as I was suggesting, is only the tip of the iceberg. But until that happens, until this campaign finance is at least...
But you were saying it's a moral problem, and now you're talking about campaign finance. I don't understand.
Well, there's a moral dilemma in the campaign finance, because on the one hand, I'm legislating against companies. On the other hand, I'm asking those very companies whom I'm legislating against to help me by giving me some money. So there's a huge moral tug of war going away.
But you're just saying that the legislation isn't effective. There should be...
Yes, and that's a very good point. What I'm suggesting is that if you took that campaign finance and really buttoned that one down, then I think there would be less problems with this very sophistic legislation that's going to be coming through, even indeed on the stuff that's going through the Senate at present.
So if I can jump in here and go back to actually that vampire squid comment, because I think that's actually very relevant to this regulatory discussion here. I mean, that comes from an article that appeared in Rolling Stone last summer, which was making the point that Goldman was really responsible for a lot of the financial, because so many former employees have Goldman have worked in, at very high levels in the government over the years. And I think that that actually does, in an odd sort of way, relate to this regulatory issue, simply because it shows that the more government involvement you have in trying to manage every little detail of how the financial system operates, the more opportunities you actually have for large institutions, whether it's Goldman or any of the others who might be trying to plant their alumni in the government, to influence how the regulatory process will work out. I mean, I think, and that's really why the best, regulation is simply to have a system where these large banks can fail, because that, if there's nothing that the government can do for you, if you run into trouble, you know, that automatically, removes a lot of the incentives for the bank to try to insert its alums into the government.
So you can wreck your economy completely, and you just say, well, it's all right, because it's fair, that's justice or something.
Well, I mean...
Because these institutions have the power to do that. They have the power to ruin all our lives.
Well, I think that...
I don't think these institutions...
Not without the government help. I mean, this finance... The housing bubble would not have been nearly as bad as it was if you hadn't had the involvement of government in the form of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all of these other regulations that were designed to try to boost home ownership by people who shouldn't necessarily have been...
I say from all three of you, I just see these fingers pointing away from Wall Street, pointing at Fannie Mae, pointing at...
Well, sorry to disappoint you, because normally I'm very critical with good reason.
You're saying if the government went away, then everyone would be fine, everyone would be moral, there would be no serious problems?
No, but I think the point that we're all making is that a lot of the reasons for... the crisis come back to policy making, bad policy making, in allowing people to get into mortgages they couldn't afford, loans they couldn't afford generally, and ultra low interest rates after the dot-com crash was another contributor to that. I still think that Greenspan should have been more aggressive in looking at the inflation of asset prices.
But you've
prices.
All spoken about loopholes, about how they've been exploiting loopholes. Surely you plug those loopholes. You don't just throw away the whole regulation system.
Well, but
the loopholes exist because of all of the previous efforts to plug them. I mean, that's just a fact of how regulation works. I mean, as soon as you create a new regulation, all of a sudden you've created an opportunity for some enterprising, financial engineer or banker to work his or her way around it.
And the legislation did require, I think, Fannie Mae and so on to be supporting poorer people. There's a specific reference in the legislation to helping the less well-off become property owners.
Enzio von Pfeil, what do you think about that principle, that if there are loopholes, that's an argument for doing away with the regulation altogether?
Well, not doing away with it, but I think what David's saying is to tighten it up to the extent, again, he comes from his perspective, I come from mine on that, what we mean by tightening up, to...
What do you mean by tightening up?
Well, what I mean is that you take away this campaign finance tug of war, because I think that the longer you have...
Yeah, sorry, that's means to an end. What's the end? What do you want the regulations to look like?
The regulations are that banks do what banks are not do, that you reinstate a Glass-Steagall, for instance, but very, very forcefully, that banks are there only to borrow and to lend money. They're not there to do all sorts of funny stuff with derivatives and synthetic derivatives.
All right, Joseph Snowberg, do you agree with that?
Well, I think that Glass-Steagall didn't create repealing Glass-Steagall didn't create the housing bubble. I think that, Fannie and Freddie helped to do that pretty significantly. I think that kind of argument we always hear
about
Glass-Steagall.
But it puts Citibank and Bank of America at much bigger risk by taking on equity-type businesses and derivative-type exposures. If AIG had been allowed to fail, which I think it should have, then there would have been quite a lot of mess to clean up in the commercial banking sector because of their exposure to all this.
Well, and I think that a bank like Citi was able to get itself into that position precisely because it assumed that it was too big to fail. I think that if you move to a system where the government, showed pretty clearly that it's willing to allow these institutions to go under...
But under Glass-Steagall, it wouldn't have been able to do a lot of what it was doing at the time of the crash. I mean, I do think you need to remove the non-lending risk from banks, because they do have ultimately duties to depositors and governments standing in the background wondering if they're going to have to bail them out. So taking away equity underwriting, derivatives trading, and leaving banks with just interest rate risk and credit risk with their loan books would make them much more understandable.
Well, but I mean, who do you think would be better at catching that kind of bad behavior, though? I mean, the creditors and investors who have to worry that the government might let the institution fail if it gets into trouble, or the regulators who are out there trying to, you know, make sure that no one's violating any Glass-Steagall or other regulation you can put in place?
Well, I think we wouldn't have to worry about the investment banks like Goldman Sachs and others collapsing if they weren't part of deposit-taking banks. Goldman Sachs now operates under a banking license, and Citibank was a hybrid vehicle, and many commercial banks, indeed most around the world, including RBS, had very large investment banking businesses embedded in them, and there's a complete culture clash at the management levels in those combined entities. But there's also a problem for regulators in trying to figure out what the real risks of the bank they're supposed to be regulating are. If they're just looking at a bank which takes deposits and makes loans, then there's a much more measurable risk that supervisors can keep an eye on. But I do think that we should look again at allowing retail depositors to lend their money more easily directly to governments. Currently, you can only do that by buying treasury bills, in Hong Kong's case, exchange fund bills. They're not liquidly traded for retail investors, and they're very, very inaccessible. But if you had a modernized postal savings bank system operated on the internet where you could simply put your money risk-free with the government, they would then take the risk of lending it back into the real world, into the commercial banking sector. And they would take the interest rate spread for doing that. That would be basically the government would receive for ultimately guaranteeing that you will always get your money back. If you said that's your option, you either get the lowest rate in town from the government or you can take risk with a commercial bank. And if you do that, we will not be bailing you out when the bank fails. I think that would be a better approach to take.
Lindsay von Pfaal, if you're a senior executive at Goldman's, what would you be doing now?
Fighting like crazy.
You would, you?
Yes, well...
Would you take it in, do you think?
No, I think that part of Goldman's problems is that they, according to the press again, that they probably could have gone for a settlement. They decided not to. So now they're going to have to fight in their corner. And as a Goldman's executive, that's what Blankfein is going to have to do with his entourage of people appearing in front of Mr. Levin. So they're justified in doing that. It's really up to the SEC to prove its case, frankly.
I think if you're going to leave emails around the place saying, hey, we found some suckers to buy this rubbish, you're asking for a PR problem, if nothing else.
Absolutely. That is not, however, you know, Goldman's has no monopoly on that type of an email, I would suggest. And again, I think that it's up to the SEC and to the Senate committee to be proving its case. But again, I can only warn that with all this campaign finance floating around in the background, anything that we see will basically be just a laughable matter.
Yeah, I think a fair point. This is not just a Goldman issue, is it?
That's correct.
Because everyone was playing by the same
rules. Goldman's is the fall guy ahead of some legislation that's going to make some people look, in a sophistic sense, quite good. But then at the same time, they're going back to Wall Street asking those very same people for money. Well, how does that one work in the Department of Morals and Ethics?
Joseph Stenberg, are you saying there's nothing very much wrong with Wall Street, really?
But I'm saying that we have to have, and I'm also not saying that I oppose each and every, you know, financial regulatory idea you could ever come up with, but I am saying that I think we need to be really realistic about what we think that regulation can achieve. And I think that if, you know, people are going in with the assumption that the bill that the Senate is due to debate this week or any other kind of legislation is going to keep this sort of situation from ever happening again, we're really in for a very expensive disappointment at some point in the future.
So you think that those sort of problems, those problems we've had in the past, could be solved principally by what?
I think it helps to understand exactly what the problem is. And I mean, with all due respect to Enzio, I think this focus on campaign contributions is a complete distraction. I think that the real things that we need to be looking at are where did the money come from for these banks to be playing with. I think the answer to that is imprudent monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. I think you look at where did this push come from to be making, you know, enormous quantities of home loans to people who probably couldn't ever be expected to repay them. The answer to that question is it came from Congress. I think that in a way it's troubling that we're putting the cart before the horse here by trying to push ahead with more regulation before this committee that's supposed to be probing into the causes of the financial crisis has even finished its work. I think that simple timing issue there shows that a lot of this regulatory talk in Congress is more about political theater than it is about addressing any of the causes of the crisis.
Okay, well, Joseph Stomo, thanks for joining us, editorial page writer of the Wall Street Journal Asia. Thanks to David Webb, founder of website.com, shareholder activist, and Dr. Enzio von Pfeil, founder of economicclock.com. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us this morning. Bring time to 20.